I'm Kenny, an alcoholic.
Hey.
God interrupted my death on August 30th, 1990. And I had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps about 2.5 years ago. So do the math. Do the math. I was thinking, let's say you're going to go to Green Bay. I don't know, I just picked Green Bay. I know I got to head west. I don't have any maps. I don't have anything. I'll get there, maybe. I don't know how long it'll take me, if I ever get there at all. But this is the GPS. This will get you there. And I found that here. I'm so grateful and honored to speak here. This group means so much to me. I can really point to three times in my life. My first step experience, when I had met this priest, about 6-7 years sober, 8, somewhere around there. And then coming here, Tommy, when I moved here to Lynbrook around 4 years, 4 years next month, and I started to go to meetings around the area, and I went to Malvern, and I joined a group over there, and, I was pretty much the way I was when I was in Queens, the same type of meeting, and, I joined that group, and, I met Tommy at the gym, and he would tell me about this group over Primary Purpose Group of Lynbrook. I said, yeah, well, what kind of meetings are they? He said, well, it's a beginner series, and they do 12 steps in a month. I said, what? 12 steps in a month? You can't do that for a beginner. It's too much. Easy does it. Because that's what I was used to, easy does it, but maybe not get there, that's the thing. He asked me to speak back in July, so for 4 months, this is what I thought about. And my mind, the mind, it's a great tool, but a lousy master. I'd be going along my day, and all of a sudden, I think of tonight. And I go, oh! And it's, my mind doesn't know. I mean, my body doesn't know that it's 4 months from now. It's like I'm here, as far as my body goes. And it's like, and I could feel it, my heart race a little bit. And it's just so insane, the mind. That's insanity, the mind. I tell you, the thinking mind gets me into so much trouble, and it did for so long. And I really didn't realize it until I came here. There was another, one of the awakenings that I found out when I got here. The thinking mind is a lot of trouble. It's a lot of trouble. My dad's side is Scottish and Irish, and my mother's side is German. That's like the perfect storm of predisposition. My great grandfather owned the bar. My grandfather owned the bar. My father was a bartender, and I drank at the bar. And plus, I serve it part time. I have a job where I serve alcohol, so we kept that in the family. And I remember even before long before I drank, I was about 12. I used to go visit my father was a bartender in Elmhurst, and I used to go over there with my Little League uniform and everything, and. He'd let me pull up the floorboards behind the bar and look for quarters. And I usually get a couple of bucks. And I found out years later, a guy used to come in and throw quarters there, a friend of his. And, this was my introduction, really to the bar business. I was 12 years old, and they had a pool table. And a guy showed me how to play pool. And that, really started off something for many years for me. The guys there used to even make side bets when I'd play, and then I'd walk out of there with money. This was, after a few months of this guy teaching me how to shoot and everything. So I just loved that whole atmosphere. It was so dark. I mean, it could be brilliant sunshine in the summer, but you went in there, it was dark, and the cigarette smoke, and the guys laughing, and it's like, you could hear, like the ice rattling around, and I thought it was the greatest thing in the world, The first time I went out to drink, I don't remember first drink, and I'm only going to talk about, why I belong here. I was about 16. We went and got a six-pack of Colt 45. We split it between three of us, and I got cockeyed. The guy I was with said something to a woman that was walking by, and she screamed at him and slapped him, and I thought it was the funniest thing in the world. I'm sure she didn't. I don't even remember what he said. But, that was the beginning, and I, I went home that night, and the lies started right away. Of course, my mother said, "You've been drinking." I said, "No." And during the night, I thought I dreamt that I threw up. I woke up in the morning, and I was sitting in it. And I looked at that, and I just thought of what I did that night, and I said, like, I couldn't wait to do this again. And that's what I did. And the progression, you know, the progression of the disease. You know, it was on weekends that I went to, you know, to college. And then, you know, in college, I really thought I could write better papers if I just got, a pint or two of Gallo Port and go to the park instead of, you know, going to the library or going to class. You know, and I hear people, you know, that, you know, they sounded like they drank like me, and then they said they got a degree. I was like, I couldn't believe it. How did they do that? Because I made all my classes in the morning so that I had the afternoon free because, you know, I was busy. You know, I had things to do. But when you go to a liquor store at 9 o'clock in the morning when it opens, well, you know, I'm not going to class. When I started to drink, that was it. And, you know, I was only 19. I withdrew. I went into the service at age 20, and that's where I became an everyday drinker. And, you know, in the service, I had a few insights into my alcoholism. I was on leave in Miami. I was stationed in Florida, Northwest Florida, and I went to visit a friend, and I was at his aunt's house. And when I got there, I said, oh, because I had to walk far. I didn't have a car. And I was sweating. It was about 95, you know, Miami in the summer. So she said, well, I got water, soda, beer, or wine. I said, oh, I'll have a glass of wine. So she brings out a glass of wine. I take a sip. I said, oh, yeah, I'm so thirsty. She said, well, if you're thirsty, why don't you ask for water? I don't know. I know today, but I didn't know then. You know, we lived in these barracks, you know, and in the barracks they had a day room with a TV. And, you know, there were a bunch of seats and couches around. And this is like a snapshot of my life. I came into that day room one night. Everybody's watching TV. I sat behind this guy, Bob. I sat down, and then I went to move his seat out of the way. He jumped up, started screaming at me. What are you doing there? I said, what? See, I wanted to, you know, manipulate everybody else to fit my life instead of for me to fit into, you know, life itself. So, you know, they say stepping on toes, you know, and then you react seemingly unprovoked, and that happened all the time. That happened in my sobriety, too, and I'll talk about that. You know, I got out of service, I came home, and left to my own devices, it was a mess. And lo and behold, in the early 80s, I got evicted. Now, booze was always my solution. So the marshal was at the door, and I come to the door, and I said, well, how much time do I have? And he said, 10 minutes. So I packed this bag. They're throwing boxes down the steps. And here I am, and this guy was living with me. So we walk down to the park. So we're sitting in the park, and I'm looking around, and it's like, wow, what do I do now? I can't believe it. We don't have any place to live. Man. So we go get a bottle. Halfway through the bottle, you know, it's not that bad. No, it's May. Now I really don't have any bills. Not that they paid them anyway, because that's how I wound up there. But, I mean, it was great. I'm out. I'm free. I thought that was freedom, see, being out and about, you know, with no place to live. You know, drinking was my solution always. And I stayed homeless probably about 3-4 years, about, I don't know, I slept in the building where I worked. My mom got sober in March of 86. But I'll tell you a little story about mom and myself. And she had pneumonia, and she was at New York Hospital. This was in the early 80s. And I went to visit her. So we went down to the solarium. At the time, you were allowed to smoke. So what I used to do is bring a pint of scotch. And that we'd go and we'd finish off this pint of scotch. I got the cups and water and everything else, and we'd have a few cigarettes, drink this pint of scotch, and, you know, then I'd leave. This is visiting her in the hospital. I didn't think anything was strange at all. And, you know, now it's like, wow, that is something. Anyway, they let her out of Seafield on St. Patrick's Day, 1986. And I went over her house, I remember that Christmas, and somebody had made up a little ornament for her tree, and it said, sobriety can be fun. I just looked at it. I said, "You got to be kidding me!" You know, I was homeless at the time. Huh? You know, it just did insanity, insanity. So I got this furnished room in Corona. I'm the only guy speaking English in Corona, and I used to have this little bodega down the corner, and he had a little file for me. I used to get stuff on credit, you know, and he called me Americano Mets. That was my name, because he saw me at Shea Stadium, and he, Americano Mets. So I stayed there for a while. And January of 1990, I came to meetings and at the behest of my family. And I found out how I was stuck in step one. I'd raise my hand, yeah, I'm alcoholic, yeah. And, you know, in fellowship and talk and laugh and everything else. And, you know, you drank a quart, I drank two quarts. I suffered more than you. I was homeless longer than you. I did this, I did that, and everything else. You know, and then my father died the early February. And, of course, I thought this was a great excuse to go drink. And that's what I did. Because I was still stuck in step one. I didn't have that innermost, you know, I didn't admit to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. I came back, nothing major, but then I was still cashing my check in the bar. Because I didn't have any ID for many years, so I said I couldn't open a bank account. So what am I going to do? There's rationalization going on, right? I got to keep going to the bar, cash a check. So I'd go there, and I'd cash a check, and I'd have a soda with my sandwich. And, like, I think it's Jim in here who goes to the whiskey and milk. And suddenly, one day, I said, throw some rum in that Coke. And I was off again. And that was a couple of months. Sometime, I think it was around August 28th of that year. I'm not sure, the date, 1990. There was this woman. I was in this furnished room. She was shooting up on the floor, and I remember sitting on the bed looking at her. I had my first step experience, which I found out here. I didn't even know that was my first step experience till I came here. But I thought to myself, and it didn't come to me. You know, the thought came to me. It wasn't from me, because I'd done all this drinking and drugs and everything else, and all of a sudden I just said, I can't do this anymore. I have to get back. So I got back, you know, to the meetings, and I said, well, I do whatever I have to do, you know, because I realized I could not do it by myself. And I wasn't the, you know, I didn't have the ego, and I was like, you know, I'm, you know, here, big deal, you know, like I was before. You know, in fact, you know, when I first came around and they would say, well, are you a newcomer? And I'd have like 2 weeks or something. I'd say, well, relatively, you know. I couldn't say I was a newcomer. I mean, you know, just insane stuff. So I came to the meetings, and there was Tommy the Hat, Tommy the Cane, and Tommy the Radio. And Tommy the Hat was my sponsor. So he would say, call me every day. And this is my journey, right? Call me every day. So I'd call him. He'd say, how you doing? I said, okay, Tommy, how you doing? He said, okay. He said, just keep doing what you're doing. I didn't know what I was doing. I was going to meetings, but, you know, that was about it, you know? And, you know, they said, you know, get involved. And, I did service, did a lot of service. And, you know, he told me to go to a meeting every day. And if you miss a meeting, the next day you go to two, double up. That didn't even really make sense then. I mean, it just, you know, it didn't. And, you know, and it... Yeah, and it continued like that, you know. I want to stick to, you know, one, two, and three. Just want to read. You know, they also found out there are moderate drinkers, hard drinkers, and real alcoholics, which I didn't realize. Now, I got to tell you, too, when I first came around, too, there were big book meetings. I used to go to them every week. But it was like a book of the month club, I call it. I mean, you know, we'd read the book, and I would say, oh, that's interesting. And then that would be it. You know, I wouldn't experience it. I wouldn't have, my own experience with, you know, each of the steps. And like I said, there was some experience I had with steps that I didn't even realize till I got here. So anyway, there's the hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome and may even need medical attention. Now, I didn't know that. You know, there are some people, God bless them, that can just put the drink down, that's their problem, and walk away happy, joyous, and free. Now, what happens when a hard drinker sponsors a real alcoholic is the solution's different. You know, and there were people that were... They were having a great time. I remember I was 6 months, and I went to this party, and everybody was dancing and having a great time. And I went there, and I was like, I drank four sodas, I had something to eat, and I had to get out of there. You know, just that irritable and discontented, unbelievable. Because I didn't realize this. And what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker, he may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. And that was me from a young age, really. Like I said, I could not, if I started, like when I was in college, if I drank in the morning, I wasn't going to class. I wasn't stopping and going anywhere else. I just kept on drinking. And I just want to read the first step so I can get it right. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learn that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently may be has to be smashed. Wow, and that's how I felt in that furnished room in Corona. You know, and I don't know how long I could have gone drinking like that. I don't know how long I would live. Because what I would do is drink about a quart and a half, and then run around chasing crack. That's what it was toward the, you know, they called it in the 80s. And I'd been, you know, I was so grateful when I'd stopped drinking that I was around for, I don't know, I was counting days, maybe I had a week. And the ninth step was the one that really caught me. Because pretty much when I was a kid, that's what my father and stepfather would do. If something happened, something was wrong, you know, here's a couple of bucks, kid, you know. And that would, like, fix everything. So when I came in, I ran around to all those bartenders that I borrowed money from, and they tell you not to go to, and I paid them. Of course, I didn't tell anybody, you know. But that's a quick fix, too, the ego, you know. That's all that is, you know, and I didn't realize at the time, of course, but I thought I was doing the right thing, you know. So I was doing a ninth step counting days. Not bad, huh? It's pretty easy, this stuff. You know, I remember I finally got a bank account, too, and it just felt so great. It felt so great to be part of society. When I got my first piece of ID, you know, to some of you that might not sound like much, but to somebody like me, it was unbelievable. My first credit card, and I ran it up at the ATM like crazy, but I paid it off. But I was so grateful. Wow. You know, I just felt, because for so many years, I just felt like I was out there. You know, I wasn't even part of society, you know. Going to friends' houses, asking for a shower, or going and asking for something to eat, or picking up the cigarette butts by the subway entrance, because that's where the long ones were, you know, they'd flick it there and then go down to the train. And, you know, and that's how I lived. So being, you know, having these things happen was just, I thought it was just the most greatest thing in the world. I remember one day, too, I took over my sister's apartment. I got out of that furnished room, and she had a studio apartment. She was moving in with a boyfriend, and I took it over, and I remember one day it was raining, and I had a bad day at work, and I got home, and I was looking out the window. It was raining. Then all of a sudden, the rain stopped. The sun came out. I just looked outside, and I just had an overwhelming feeling everything was going to be okay. That was like an awakening, too. And I just looked around, you know, and I thought to myself, and I can remember, I have closets. I was grateful for closets. I had two closets. I didn't have closets for years. I was out on the street, and I had a furnished room. I had no closets there, you know. It was just an amazing thing. And, you know, that was like a real sense of God being with me, you know. I just want to read this. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? As soon as a man can say that he does believe, or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure him that he is on his way. And, you know, when I came here and then I was taken through the book and shown that, you know, it was a wonderful experience. And you know, I take people through the book now, and what's great is a couple of people, a couple of friends, you know, they have 15 years or so, and they've never been through the book, you know. And I go away on retreats. Now, as a disclaimer, there's no AA retreats, but people in AA go on retreat. You know, if it's sponsored by the General Service or the local intergroup, you can call it a retreat. Otherwise, it's not. But I will say that, you know, that might have been a major reason that kept me sober for a while. You know, going and having a conscious contact with a higher power. But I go on retreats now, and I see friends that are miserable. They haven't been through the book, you know. And, you know, because, and they're with guys that saying, you know, don't drink, go to meetings, everything's going to be okay. And it's not. You know, it's not for the real alcoholic. You have to have the solution, you know. And they say, you know, sit here and don't worry. If you don't get AA, AA will get you. It doesn't. It doesn't work by osmosis. I found that out. And then the third step, you know, it takes in a lot. The third step, you know, they go through different things, you know. When I was taken through here, they asked me the true and false questions, you know, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. True. That probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. True. That God couldn't win if he was sought. Being convinced of those things, we were at step three. And, you know, I only read it because I don't memorize all this stuff. Believe me, I don't have the third and seventh step prayer memorized. I'll tell you, when I first came around, a guy had the preamble memorized, and I was very impressed with that. I thought, that's pretty good. Pretty good. You know, they go through different things, though. You know, our self or self-centeredness, that is the root of our troubles, you know. I never thought I really hurt people, but, you know, I love Seinfeld, and in Seinfeld, Kramer's in the bar one night, and he's sitting next to this guy, and he says, well, here's the feeling good all the time, and then he drinks. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to feel good all the time. And it didn't matter what it was. But drinking was my favorite, and it was always there, you know. You try to control my own happiness. It's a little self-centered, huh? I would think. So, now that we're at the third step prayer, God, I offer myself to thee to build me and do with me as thou wilt, to relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those that would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Now, when I first came around, I thought the third step was this. Okay. I thought that was it, because I thought these were the steps too. Not just an excerpt from chapter 5. I thought, what you read here, that's what it was. And I said, okay, that's it. But today I know that it's, you know, it's trusting in care of God to take care of us, and that going on with the rest of the program, taking risks in life that are going to be beneficial for us, knowing that God will be there, that we're going to be okay, is like the net. You know, no matter what we're going to do, he's going to have our back. And then next week. Thank you.